be an environmental cold case detective story, discovery and repair of the soil cover on the Cell 3 landfill. I'll be introducing you to our presenters today, and I just wanted to cover a quick reminder that this is part of an ongoing series of webinars that we've been hosting on the Cleanup Information Network. Later on today, I'll be walking through a whole list of the upcoming webinars and how you can access the previously recorded ones. But in the interest of time, I want to jump right into the technical presentation that we have for today. So again, let me introduce you to our presenters. We'll be joined by four speakers today. Emily Klein from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is a project manager for USAFE and has more than 10 years of experience in geological and environmental investigations. She graduated from the University of Delaware with a BS in geology and has worked for state and federal and private entities throughout her career. Her area focus has been serving her federal clients under the Military Munitions Response, Operational Range Assessment, and Installation Restoration Programs, as well as formerly used defense sites. We'll also be joined by Tim Peck, who's also with the Army Corps of Engineers. Mr. Peck has nearly 35 years of experience in environmental compliance in government and consulting industries. In his early career as a project geologist, he managed subsurface investigations to address various project issues, including petroleum underground storage tanks, chlorinated solvent releases, coal tar sites, sinkhole impacts, as well as wellhead protection and a whole slew of other technical projects. He came over as the lead USAFE project manager for the National Army National Guard Operational Range Assessment Program. And since 2009, for that group, he's been working as well with their PFAS environmental program in 2017. We will also be joined by Jerry Kashuta. And Jerry works with more than 40 years of experience, 34 years in environmental investigations and remediation, with 6 years in engineering design. He has worked at AECOM since 1992 and on the Fort Meade environmental projects since 2002. His work experience includes consulting in environmental and geologic investigations and remediation, regulatory permit at the state level, teaching at the college level, and some mechanical engineering design in private practice. And then last, we'll also be joined by Mitch Kyler. Mitch has served as a storm water program manager for Fort Meade since 2015 and is currently the president of the Maryland Stream Restoration Association. He has served with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and also previously with the Maryland Department of Natural Resources and the Maryland Department of Environment. He holds a Bachelor's of Science in both Environmental Geography and Cartography with a focus on geomorphology from Ohio University. He also has certificates in Natural Resource Management and Governance from the University of Maryland. So with that very warm set of welcome to our presenters, I'm going to go ahead and call up our presentation materials and turn it over to our very first speaker. So as the presentation materials load over here, I will ask Jerry if he's able to unmute and just let me know if he's ready to begin.
I'm ready.
All right, take it away, Jerry.
Thank you, Jane. We are going to take you through the rediscovery, investigation, and remedy of an old landfill at Fort Meade, Maryland, identified as Cell 3 of the closed sanitary landfill. The presentation will assume a crime scene investigation. First, we will take you to the scene of the crime and present the location and history of Cell 3 and explain how it was rediscovered. Then, we will get into the detective work. The contract setup and modifications is the crux of the talk and what made this project a success. Crime scene investigation includes the initial assessment of the landfill along with the then current uses of the landfill, which led to changes in the conditions of the work that needed to be performed, which led to a change in the contract. Solving the case includes the work done to prepare the landfill and the work that was performed on the landfill. We will finish with the installation's perspective and issues. You have already been introduced to the presenters, and I would like to introduce the sections that they will present. Inspector Emily Klein will start us off by discussing the scene of the crime and opening the case file. She will present the history of the site and explain how the site was forgotten and then rediscovered. Inspector Tim Peck will walk us through the contract portions of the detective work. Cell 3 was, and still is, actively used for stockpiling for construction projects on post, and this wasn't going to stop while the remedy was enacted. this had to be accounted for in the contract, which required a modification. I am Inspector Jerry Cachetis, and I will present the physical work done at Cell 3, including getting the site ready for the remedial action and presenting what was done to get Cell 3 into compliance. We will finish with a conversation with Inspector Mitch Kyler, who will provide the installation's perspective and the issues he had to deal with and still deals with, as Cell 3 is still being used for ongoing construction projects. I would like to hand this over to Inspector Emily Klein, and she will take us through the scene of the crime.
Thank you, Inspector Cachetis. So now we're going to walk through the scene of the crime. For those of you who are unfamiliar, Fort Meade is an active Army installation that's located approximately 20 miles northeast of Washington, D.C. You can see in the inset in the top left-hand corner that Fort Meade is located approximately halfway between Baltimore and Washington, D.C. Fort Meade was established in 1917 and currently encompasses approximately 5,000 acres. Where we're going to focus is the closed sanitary landfill, which is located on the southeastern portion of the installation. You can see it's cross-hatched in the larger figure here. These are two aerials of Fort Meade. You can see, again, in the left-handmost aerial, the closed sanitary landfill is outlined in red. And then within the closed sanitary landfill, there are three landfill cells, cells 1, 2, and 3, as you can see on the right-hand figure. Cell 3 is going to be the focus of this investigation. Cell 3 encompasses approximately 38 acres. So with the benefit of hindsight, we're going to look at the facts of this case. The crime was that landfill operations began at Cell 3 in 1958 and ended in 1976. The modus operandi was the trench and fill method, which in this case consisted of unlined trenches that were dug approximately 10 to 12 feet below ground surface, were approximately 600 foot in length and approximately 20 foot wide. These trenches were then filled with mixed residential, commercial, and non-hazardous waste that were deposited, compacted, and covered daily with film, with cover material. Concealing the evidence, Cell 3 was closed in 1976 with a 2-foot soil cover. This was in accordance with the regulations at the time, which were prior to the modern regulations that we use today that were implemented in 1988. If you look on the left-hand portion of this figure, you can see historical aerials of the Cell 3 location. The first one, top one, is from 1943, and you can see the area is largely wooded. The next figure is from 1963 and shows the westernmost portion of Cell 3 where there's some ground scarring and landfill operations occurring. The third figure down shows the landfill in full swing where most the entire area is clear. There's some access roads and it's being actively used as a landfill at that time. In 1988, you can see portions of the landfill have been revegetated, although there are still some access roads and other areas are cleared of vegetation and have been used for stockpiling operations. So why did Cell 3 become a cold case? We're talking about a 38-acre landfill here. How did we lose track of a 38-acre landfill? There are a few factors that contributed to this. One factor was that although landfill operations ceased at Cell 3 in 1976, they continued on cells 1 and 2 until the mid-1990s. On these cells, the landfill method transitioned from the trench and fill to the area fill method, in which trash was placed on the ground surface and compacted and then covered with a soil cover. And then another factor that contributed to Cell 3 being lost to the records was that paper records and institutional knowledge from personnel turnover at the installation was caused loss of information over the decades. Additionally, there are outdated management practices that were implemented at Cell 3, including reforestation, like what we saw in the historical aerial of 1988, where areas were actively reforested, which is not typical of today's regulations. We don't plant trees on top of landfill caps to, you know, ensure that the cap isn't disturbed, which that made it very difficult to identify SEL3 as a historical landfill. Additionally, there are ongoing stockpiling operations that continue to this day, which made it difficult to identify topographic features that we generally associate with landfill cells, such as hummocky topography. Now we're going to go through some of the historical records and see how the landfill was lost in the records over time. So this is a figure from a solid waste management study that was dated in 1989. You can see the outline of what was called the sanitary landfill in this document, but what we are calling the closed sanitary landfill. So at the time, the landfill was operational. And you can see that the outline of the sanitary landfill includes cell 3, as well as cells 1 and 2, and is divided by two stream sections, which then converge on the western portion of the landfill. This next document is from the closure plan for cell 1 that is from 1994. Now, these two figures are the same figure. One is simply blown up slightly, and one is has different features called out. I've taken the liberty of labeling the three cells so we know where they are. However, at the time when this figure was created, it only labeled cells 1 and 2. Cell 3 was not identified as a landfill cell. So even from 1989 to 1994, we see a slippage of some of that information. And this figure shows the topography at that time. So this is what the cells looked like in 1994. You can see there are some stockpiles that we can visibly see on cell 3, and you can see the topographic relief from the contours on cells 1 and 2. So from the same document, this is, again, the same figure 1 simply enlarged, and I labeled cells 1, 2, and 3 on this one as well. They identified cell 3 as a future landfill cell, so it was not identified as a cell at the time. They were projecting that it would be the location of a landfill cell in the future. And you can see an excerpt taken from this document. It says, cell 3, approximately 20 acres, is a future cell, which should start construction in the mid-2000s. Shelving the case. So even though cell 3 was slated to be a future landfill cell, all landfilling operations ceased at the CSL in 1996. Both cells 1 and 2 were capped and closed between 1995 and 1998. And in that time period between the 1990s and the mid-2000s, much of the information was lost. Opening the case. Now we're going to go through some of the environmental investigations that began the rediscovery of cell 3. So this figure is taken from a 2007 remedial investigation that was conducted at the CSL for groundwater. This investigation included the installation and sampling of groundwater monitoring wells as well as test pitting. The test pit locations are identified on this figure as TR-1A through TR-16. They're in brown on the southeastern portion of cell 3. Within these trenches, they identified sanitary waste and construction debris that consisted of residential, commercial, and non-hazardous industrial waste in 5 of the 6 trenches. Additionally, soil samples were collected from the trenches for full suite analysis, which included volatile organic compounds, semi-volatile organic compounds, polyaromatic hydrocarbons, pesticides, and target analyte list metals. Of all of these analyses that were conducted, arsenic was the only constituent that was consistently over the risk-based industrial screening criteria. However, arsenic was below the maximum background concentration for Fort Meade. So at this point, the team has speculated as to why Cell3 wasn't, you know, pulled aside as a site to be included in the installation restoration program or the IRP. We suspect that because no significant contamination was identified as a result of the test pitting, and there were also groundwater wells that were sampled around the exterior of the closed sanitary landfill boundary, as well as the fact that Cell 3 was closed in accordance with the regulations at the time, i.e. in 1976, that this site was determined to be lower priority and was shelved and again largely forgotten. So between 2007 and 2013, a new remedial project manager took over at Fort Meade and was unfamiliar with the history of Cell 3, largely for the reasons that we've previously discussed. In 2013, a contract was put in place to remove some of the soil stockpiles on the western portion of Cell 3. You can see in the figure at the bottom here, the inset, the location of these stockpiles. So as these stockpiles were being removed, the contractor continued to remove soil, trying to reach native soils. However, since all of Cell 3 was a landfill, they were never going to reach native soils without first encountering waste, which is exactly what happened. They encountered a textile cover and buried waste beneath the stockpiles. And as a result of removing much of the soil cover, a large depression formed, and the depression began filling with water, which was causing issues for the landfill cell. We don't want standing water on a landfill cell. So as a result of this, this was the catalyst to include Cell 3 in the installation restoration program. Additionally, as they realized that there was trash beneath this portion of the landfill, they also started to notice that there were some irregular and hummocky bedding in other portions where the trash was degrading at different rates. So there was obvious need to repair the soil cover. These are some photos from that 2013 effort to remove the stockpiles. The left-hand upper photo shows the large depression where water was pooling. The upper right-hand photo shows one of the stockpiles as it's being removed, and the two lower photos show what was typical of the waste material that they were uncovering. So now we're going to poll the audience. Have anyone in the audience ever come across a site that was buried or forgotten?
And so, Emily, this is Jean. I'm just going to chime in here since this is our first poll for the audience. There are some new boxes on the bottom half of your screen, and you'll be able to check off the box to the left of any of the answers that you agree with in that box on the left. And then just next to that on the right, if you happen to pick other, you can actually type in a personal response explaining what other means. And we'll be able to see the distribution of answers as they come in. And so, Emily, I'm starting to see a pattern emerge here, but I will just remind the audience.
It appears that many people have encountered this before. Oh my goodness, all kinds of stuff. I've definitely encountered munitions before as well. Abandoned vehicles, ooh, sarin and mustard gas, you don't want to encounter that. Wow, so obviously this is a common issue. uncovering unknown sites that we were previously unaware of. So now we're going to actually have Inspector Peck take us through how we address this site with the contract.
All right. So Tim, you should be able to unmute and carry on.
Thank you, Inspector Klein. You just reviewed the history of the case up to the point when the crime scene remains were discovered in 2013. We only learned about this history when we had completed our detective work. But what was our detective strategy? The strategy began with the Sol 3 landfill site being identified for CERCLA action in the Army IRP program. After IRP funding was programmed, we worked with Fort Meade to plan a performance-based contract, which was awarded in 2015. I will review this contract strategy. Later, Inspector Cachetis will review the gathering of the evidence that began in 2016. Let's briefly review the theory of performance-based acquisition, or PBA. In this approach, the contract is structured around the end results, not specific scope activities. We define the performance objectives for the project or our goals for success. PBA allows the contractor to innovate more cost-effective approaches because theoretically the contractor is the expert. A fixed price contract is used, which shifts risk from the government to the contractor. A large part of the risk is based on how well the project setting is. But with this situation, in reality, it is a risk to all parties. The risk is still in the project. The contractor will manage excess risk within the government. Added risk also may diminish project success. If we can find ways to lower the risk, success is elevated, which also may reduce cost. In this strategy, we try to limit the unknowns and reduce contingencies, but still, there are other factors that will impact the project. For example, it's hard to predict the regulatory approval process in time and their ultimate technical acceptance. In a large open site on an active facility, site conditions can easily change, such as discovered construction problems, weather impacts, site access issues. In the PBA for this project, we used the best value approach. In proposal reviews, we did not take the lowest price, but initially, not knowing price, we looked for an effective and complete strategy that realistically address known and potential technical issues. With an effective strategy, we then looked at cost in this competitive procurement. The performance objectives included the repair of the Sol 3 cover in compliance with appropriate regulations, and also to achieve a final remedial investigation of the CERCLA compliance site. This task order had a 5-year period of performance for these and other tasks. My government team worked to reduce the risk by setting clear, realistic expectations. We provided available data reports. We let it be known that the state would likely allow a 2-foot soil cover to be the final remedy given the age of the landfill. We anticipated grandfathering in pre-1988 landfill regulations. Another issue, there were large soil stockpiles at the site, which could potentially be used for the cover instead of requiring transport of clean soil to the site. Photos of the soil stockpiles are shown here, which were on the east side of Cell 3. You can see the large quantity available. We made the situation known so the contractors could consider their options to complete work to innovate their proposed approach. They had to assess if the stockpile soil was of sufficient quality for use on the cover. In the proposal, we still look for a contingency to transport clean fill in case the site condition did not work. We needed a guarantee in this performance-based contract that the proposed approach will work in any case. In conclusion, for this strategy, we work to make an effective contractor-government relationship that will bring project success. The government did its homework to provide site information. We wanted to avoid possible surprises in the project later on. We wanted to avoid insufficient proposals in the level of effort and had a lack of understanding of the problems. The lowest cost in this best value approach may not bring success in this complicated project. And again, we outline the expectations as much as feasible while not being prescriptive in the project approach and methods. With clear expectations and a well-defined project setting, risk is lowered, which will lead to lower proposed project costs. Okay, with our detective strategy set, our next move is to start gathering the evidence. Inspector Cachetis will review how this case was finally solved, but stay tuned, folks. Later on, you will see how major site conditions changed and how the detective team had to regroup again to make it solid. On to you, Inspector.
Thank you, Inspector Peck. Now we have proof that Cell 3 is a landfill, but we are uncertain of its dimensions. So we need to gather more evidence. Different reports have presented different outlines of Cell 3. This slide presents the different outlines from a 1994, a 2007, a 2014, and a 2014 report, and an outline based on a review of historic aerial photographs. I want to point out two things. The access road across the middle of Cell 3, and the area of trees north of the access road that Inspector Emily Klein had mentioned earlier. I will talk about the road and these trees in later slides. First, we must figure out the outline of Cell 3. We did this with a preliminary study. The objective of the preliminary study was to collect information on the lateral extent of Cell 3 and the thickness of the existing soil cover through a geophysical survey and the excavation of test pits. A geophysical survey was conducted to help define the boundary of Cell 3. EM31 and magnetometer gradiometer surveys were conducted. This slide shows the results of the EM31 survey. I want to draw your attention to these linear features north of the roadway. I will talk about these linear features in a later slide. The test pit investigation included the excavation of 75 test pits and 6 trenches at Cell 3. The locations of the test pits are presented on this slide using a LiDAR image as a backdrop. I will discuss the LiDAR image in a later slide. Household trash and construction debris were identified during the test pit investigation. The test pits were excavated to the first encountered landfill trash or native soil. As I pointed out in a previous slide, there is a section of Cell 3 north of the road that is wooded. This slide contains 2 pictures of the wooded area as viewed from the road. As you walk through this wooded area, you notice a series of linear hummocks all trending in the same direction. It's probably most obvious in the top center of the picture here. These weren't obvious until you started looking for them. Those linear hummocks in the woods can be seen on this December 2011 LiDAR image. You can see it all here north of the roadway. They appear to extend across most of the undisturbed area of Cell 3 and are interpreted to be remnants of the trench and fill landfilling that occurred from 1958 to 1976. The LiDAR imagery was obtained from Maryland's GIS web portal. These linear features match what I pointed out in the geophysical slide showing the results of the EM31 survey. Also on this image, you can see some piles of soil piles that I'm going to talk about in a future slide. During the preliminary investigation, specifically while excavating the test pits, we noticed that the boundary of Cell 3 coincides with a change in slope. This change in slope was obvious over approximately two-thirds of the perimeter of cell 3. It was determined that the change in slope is the boundary of cell 3. A slope gradient map was obtained from Anne Arundel County. It graphically depicts the slope as percent rise based on the LiDAR data. As can be seen, higher slope values or steeper slope are in yellow, orange, and then red. The steeper slope stands out more prominently on this slope gradient map, and the steep slope corresponds with the cell 3 boundary. Using the geophysical data, tested data, LiDAR, and slope gradient, the complete outline of cell 3 could be drawn as you see it on this figure. Once we determine the boundary of cell 3, the remedial investigation feasibility study could begin. The spring of 2016 to the fall of 2017 was spent preparing the work plan, conducting the field work, and preparing the internal draft report. It took all of 2019 and most of 2020 to get the draft reviewed, address comments, and get approval of the final. But I'm getting ahead of myself, because after the site reconnaissance and mapping of the boundary of cell 3, we have other issues to deal with. There were piles of construction debris in the western portion of cell 3 and soil stockpiles in the eastern portion of cell 3. These soil stockpiles were considered part of the current site conditions. I will go into more detail about these debris piles and stockpiles later, but first, Inspector Peck will talk about how these issues affect the contract.
Thank you, Inspector. You just detailed major changes in site conditions from what we knew in 2015. Those huge soil stockpiles were not going away. Our work is now reduced to the western 6 acres as of 2019. These large changes required a contract modification. In the calculation for the modification, I looked at the lower cost of a soil cover for 6 acres versus the original cost of a cover on 38 acres. The difference in cost would be part of the modification. We used that cost reduction to manage changed site conditions. With the existing contracts, with the existing contract funding obligation, we could address other new in-scope issues which added costs back in. So what we did was realign the majority of cost savings from the smaller 6 acre action to these other issues. Now, what were these added issues? The RI gave the final delineation of the complete extent of the old cell 3 landfill that actually extended further west than realized even as far back as 1994. That extension included the area of stockpile rock and concrete rubble. That was a significant change in site condition. As the RI and FS were not at an approval stage yet, as Jerry, Inspector Cachetas just mentioned, it had a longer time for eventual approval. We needed to keep the project moving forward. I had to keep my eye on the 5-year performance period. So the project team developed a new strategy to get that cover repair completed in a timely way. The solution was using a non-time critical removal action. So new tasks were added, which included an action memo and engineering evaluation to document the landfill cover action. Another issue was managing those multiple piles of rubble. We used the state of Maryland guidance on reuse of dredged material, which also applies to concrete rubble. Also, we needed to add in a stable roadway across the center of that landfill. Finally, there would be some debris that would require off-site disposal. All of these issues were considered in the modification. But I also continue to work to reduce risk and cost at this time. I set up unit costs for tonnage of debris for off-site disposal. If units for disposal were not used, we could deobligate those cost items off the contract later. And the reuse of rubble in the base of the cover allow for a significant cost savings. Okay, now I will hand it back over to Inspector Cachetas, who will describe the resolution of this cold case.
First, we have an audience question. In your opinion, what type of contract would work best in this situation? Get some results in here. Like cost reimbursable was up. That's changing now. Time and materials. And again, if you have an other, you want to describe, you could put your answers in the question section. Firm fits. All right, it's like maybe time and materials. You just beat now cost reimbursable.
This is 10, so and yeah, so cost reimbursable sounds like a good option. At the beginning of this project, I guess we thought we knew as much as we needed to know, but things changed. One downfall or one negative of a cost reimbursable contract, it takes a lot more effort on the part of the government and the contractor to manage because you have to track all your costs. So that requires more effort.
All right, I think we're done with the questioning. Let's move on with the cold case. All right, thank you, Inspector Peck. Because we had documentation that cell 3 was closed with a 2-foot soil cover in 1976, the remedy was to repair this existing 2-foot soil cover. There were places where there was less than 2 feet of soil cover due to erosion. Plus, the cover had to be sloped so rainwater wouldn't accumulate. The eastern 31.8 acres are being used for the stockpile of soil from construction projects, and that was going to be incorporated into the remedy. We will talk about the eastern 31.8 acres later. First, I'm going to talk about the western 6.2 acres, which is outlined in green on this figure. This slide is a blow-up of the western 6.2 acres showing where superficial debris was stored. This superficial debris consisted of construction and maintenance debris. You can see from the legend that there were telephone poles, concrete rubble, dumpsters, and other debris scattered across the western portion of cell 3. The next several slides will show some photographs of this debris. There were piles of old telephone poles and the concrete bases for streetlights. These came from the local electrical contractor when they moved the power lines below ground. There were several piles of asphalt and stone, some mixed with dirt, that came from other construction projects on post. In the past, concrete storage bins were built on the western portion of cell 3. The two upper pictures are a 5-bay concrete storage bin with most of the bins filled. The bottom left picture is a 2-bay concrete storage bin that is empty. There was also metal pipe and jersey barriers stored on cell 3 as shown in the bottom right picture. The jersey barriers in the background are taller than typical jersey barriers. Here are a few pictures of the dumpsters and roll-offs stored on the western portion of cell 3, and another picture of a pile of concrete with rebar. We had to deal with all this construction debris before we could start our repairs of the 2-foot soil cover. In order to save cost and time, we thought about reusing some of this material as a base for the repair of the cover. I mentioned a few slides ago that part of the repair work for the cover was to ensure that rainwater would not pond on the landfill surface. When we started work, cell 3 was flat, and as Inspector Klein indicated earlier, after excavation at stockpile A, a depression filled up with water. In order to make sure rainwater does not pond on the landfill, the design would incorporate a 4% slope. In order to achieve this, the middle of the landfill would have to be raised several feet. Now, this is important because of the variance request. In order to save time and money, we asked the state for a variance to reuse the construction debris as a base in the middle portion of the landfill, and we would place soil on top of it. The variance request began with a work plan to sample the piles of concrete, asphalt, and soil and compare the analytical results to the EPA regional screening levels, or RSLs, for industrial soil. We did that, and there was no contamination, so we were allowed to break the concrete into pieces less than 6 inches in size and use it along with the asphalt and soil as base material as long as there was at least 3 feet of soil above it. As I mentioned, part of the design for the 2-foot soil cover repair was to assure rainwater drained off the landfill by incorporating a 4% slope. In order to get a 4% slope, the middle part of the landfill cover had to be raised at least 6 feet, thus allowing us to reuse the crushed concrete, asphalt, and soil as base material. Although this was a CERCLA action, state approval was required for the design of the cover repairs and erosion and sediment control. We prepared a design for the repair of the 2-foot soil cover and got NDE solid waste approval because it is an old landfill. The design also included an erosion and sediment control plan because of the amount of land being disturbed. NDE solid waste and the NDE sediment and stormwater plan review division reviewed the design and the sediment and erosion control plan concurrently. Approval of both was received in late 2019. We took a chance and moved to the site prior to MDE solid waste and MDE sediment and stormwater plan review division approval of the plans because we knew we can do non-invasive work to get this site repaired before we got MDE approval for the invasive work. As you can see by the last date on this slide, things worked out for us. We got a meeting with the MDE sediment and stormwater plan review division representative shortly after we got approval of our erosion and sediment control plan. The next several slides will include images of some of this non-invasive work we conducted. After we mobilized to the site and received our equipment, we were able to break and crush all the piles of concrete into smaller pieces to be reused as base material. The concrete storage bins also had to be broken up and crushed. The DPW wanted to keep the Jersey barriers, so we moved them to a different location. The telephone poles and the dumpsters were removed by others. The image on the right and bottom of the slide shows what we used to break up the concrete, and the image on the left shows what we used to crush the concrete. We crushed 1,500 cubic yards of concrete and asphalt to use as base material. We were able to survey for the limit of disturbance, silt fence, and filter logs because this was non-invasive work. And we did tree clearing, provided we did not remove any of the stumps. After we had the meeting with the MDE Sediment and Stormwater Plan Review Division representative, we began installing erosion control measures. This slide summarizes the type and quantity of erosion control measures installed. The next few slides will show the installation of erosion and sediment control measures. We installed 1,950 linear feet of filter log. The top picture shows the crew installing the filter log along one of the existing berms. The other two pictures show installed filter log. These are some of the gabion or stone outlet structures installed. The design is for the berms to direct water to these structures, and these structures allow the water to drain off the landfill into surrounding areas. Construction entrances with mountable berms had to be installed on the road at either end of our site in order to keep dirt off the adjacent roadways. This is the western construction entrance, and this is the eastern construction entrance. We had to install appropriate tree protection and silt fence. In the southwest corner of the landfill, where the majority of the rainwater flows, the design called for a letdown in sediment trap. Inside the sediment trap are baffles, which you can see in these photos. The left picture shows the sediment trap with a letdown just barely visible. The letdown is the gray stone on the right side of the picture. This picture is after the sediment trap was constructed and before grass growth. The right picture shows grass beginning to grow and the sediment trap working effectively. The letdown is the gray gravel on the left side of this picture. We incorporated existing conditions to the maximum extent possible. We used existing side slopes because they were already stabilized with grass, trees, and brush. The location of this letdown is one location where erosion had created a gully. We engineered the gully and lined it with rocks to create this letdown. Now that the erosion control measures were installed, we can start the cover repairs. We used soil that was stockpiled on the eastern 31 acres. Some soil had to be sorted to remove larger debris. This was especially necessary when we needed topsoil in the top 5 to 8 inches of our cover in order to get grass to grow. In this picture, you can see the sorting machine, and in the background is the existing berm we incorporated into our design and the filter log on top of the berm. You can also see a lot of orange stakes in the background. These surveyed stakes tell the crew how much they're to add in order to reach the required 4% slope. I mentioned that the design called for using existing berms when present. The right side image is of an area where we had to build up the berm to the design height. We modified 1,535 feet of existing berm and constructed 235 feet of new berm along the edges of the cover. The left side is an image of dirt that was moved and spread. Here are some images of finished grade or nearly finished grade. The 4% slope is probably most obvious in the bottom left photo. We moved over 27,000 cubic yards of soil to repair or upgrade the western portion of cell 3. As we finished the section, we would cover it with erosion control matting rather than seed and straw. This proved to be beneficial because that summer we had a couple of rainstorms with an inch or two of rain per hour. Water was pouring off the cover, but the matting made sure we did not have any erosion. We installed 26,000 square feet of erosion control matting. This image is taken from the western end of cell 3 looking east. Off to the bottom right, you can see that start of that letdown I described earlier. You can also see berms to the left and the right of the entire area is prepped for grass growth. More than 27,000 square feet of the western portion of cell 3 required grass stabilization. I mentioned that the road runs pretty much down the middle of cell 3. This road was incorporated as the high point for the 4% slope. We had to raise this road several feet to obtain the proper slope. This is an image of the finished road. We improved over 600 feet of permanent roadway, but we also installed 450 feet of temporary roadway. Because the road is the only way to access the eastern 31 acres of cell 3, and the other two cells of the closed sanitary landfill, we were not allowed to shut it down while we did the cover repairs. Therefore, we had to install a temporary roadway so trucks can still get around our work area. And then we removed that temporary roadway after we completed the repairs of the permanent road. Throughout the entire process of repairing the 2-foot soil cover on the western 6.2 acres, we had to deal with a lot of truck traffic. And I'm happy to report we had no safety incidents. Just wanted to show the contrast between what the western portion of cell 3 looked like before we started work and how it appears now. The two left side pictures and the right side picture show the same area where debris piles used to be located and no longer are. This slide presents the quantities of repairs done to the soil cover. I presented these quantities in previous slides. This slide just summarizes everything. This case is mostly closed for the western 6.2 acres of cell 3, but the eastern 31 acres is still active. I would like to bring in Inspector Kyler to chat about that work. Inspector Kyler, we just went through all the work to get the western 6.2 acres of cell 3 into compliance, but cell 3 also extends to the east to the tune of 31.8 acres. This image shows the overall plan for the eastern portion of cell 3. What has been going on in the eastern portion of cell 3?
Thank you for asking, Inspector Cassiatis. I imagine some of our audience has been wondering about those 31 acres. This part of cell 3 has been the repository for soil from many construction projects on Fort Meade. Beginning in 2017, Fort Meade worked with a tenant organization that had a large excavation project to manage their spoils on the 31-acre tract. The contractor took on the MDE NPDES construction activity permit and worked with our environmental division to create a grading plan that would assure that at least 2 feet of additional cover would be added across the site so that it would be in compliance with the MDE solid waste requirements. Between 2017 and 2020, approximately 250,000 cubic yards of soil were brought to the 31-acre area at the stockpile. During the peak of operations, this area received up to 300 truckloads of soil a day, which traversed through the Stockpile West cover project.
This image shows the outline of some of the soil stockpiles several years ago, before additional soil was brought in. The next slide will show some photographs of these stockpiles. On this image, how were the stockpiles originally segregated?
Projects were originally segregated by ownership. Fort Meade's privatized water and sewer contractor, electrical, and the State Highway Administration all managed their own areas. It was like children in a sandbox. The further apart they were from each other, the better the management of the operations. There have only been a couple of times in the past where Fort Meade actively managed the stockpiles. For the most part, contractors managed their materials for compliance, and we, Fort Meade, enforce.
This slide contains several photographs of the soil stockpiles over the years. You can see erosion in some of them. What was done to repair and maintain these stockpiles?
The soils at Fort Meade fall mostly into one of two soil types, sandy loam and sandy clay loam. Both soils have a very high erosion factor. If proper erosion and sediment control practices are not implemented, we tend to see erosion features like rills and gullies form quickly. The common theme with all these pictures is unvegetated slopes. The soil fertility is so low that it's difficult to grow anything on these soils without adding amendments. Even more difficult if you are outside the normal growing season for grass. We have learned from these mistakes and now look to amend the soils, track in seed and mulch when we are in final grading, and add matting to our slopes like curlex or jute mesh, which really help to reduce erosion and trap moisture. Growing grass on sand is a tricky business.
Mm-hmm. This slide contains additional photographs of some of the problems you had with the soil stockpiles over the years. What was going on in these photographs?
Inspector Cassiatis, what you see in the upper left-hand corner is the preferred state of conditions. Perimeter controls are in place. Slopes are stabilized, and gabion letdowns have been installed to allow for construction of a second soil lift. The picture in the upper right-hand corner shows how quickly things can get out of control when you do not manage materials properly. In this case, the contractor continued to bring in soils mixed with bentonite, a clay used as a lubricant in hydraulic directional drilling operations. They worked the materials during the winter when they were frozen, shaping them like there were no issues with the material. When a spring thaw came, we experienced a slump failure, and their excavator was buried up to the cab. At this point, the Maryland Department of the Environment stepped in to make sure we got back on the right path. The bottom left shows the same area I just talked about after we removed the materials that closed the haul road. The picture on the bottom right is the same location 1 year later and in compliance with erosion and sediment control standards.
For the soil cover repair of the western 6.2 acres, we used soil from stockpile A. How is stockpile A being managed?
Stockpile A is the active soil receiving and borrow facility for all jobs on Fort Meade. Inspector Cachetis, Fort Meade has a clean soils criteria for all of our contractors working on post who use the stockpile for disposal. This is how Fort Meade restricts construction debris from entering into the stockpile. By enforcing that we only receive clean soils, it makes it easy for the fort to repurpose materials to any jobs that may require clean fill. We have had soils repurposed for roads, building pads, and as clean fill for remediation projects. Stockpile A will continue to serve until it meets its projected capacity limit, or there is another large soil generating project to take over the permit and move the erosion and sediment control plan into phase four, which is when the stockpile A is going to be assimilated into a larger west plateau. In any case, it looks like there will be a continued effort to pile materials higher and deeper.
When we did the repairs to the western 6.2 acres, we used up the available soil at stockpile A and had to finish our repairs by taking soil from the east plateau, which is the far eastern extent of the stockpiles. Here you can see us grading the borrow area and placing seed and matting over the area. Why was this necessary?
This area was already considered stabilized, and the MDE erosion and sediment control permit is managed by a contractor who is in the process of closing out this permit. No one at Fort Meade was eager to work in this area, and because of that, assurances were needed from the AECOM team that disturbance would be limited to a specific area and stabilization would include a properly graded slope, soil amendments, and seed tracked in with Curlex matting. Pulling the final materials for the job from this location gave the AECOM team confidence that they would have adequate materials to finish the job.
Now we're just waiting for the grass to grow. Why can this be stressful?
Inspector Cachetis, as I mentioned earlier, there have been a lot of painful lessons learned at Fort Meade stockpile on how to best grow grass on sand. Not an easy task with so much riding on it. What I mean by this is the MDE erosion and sediment control standards require achieving 95% coverage. This is more difficult with our soil types, and so much of being successful is influenced by the time of year. The AECOM project was wrapping up final grading in the middle of the summer when the team first sowed seed. The heat and the drought were factors in a low germination rate. Later in the fall, a second application of seed was applied, and from all appearances, it looks like there is a much higher germination rate. So many construction projects come down to the site stabilization being the last item to be addressed prior to closeout. That is why it can be stressful.
Thank you, Inspector Tyler. We have another audience question. In your opinion, are the existing soil stockpiles on the eastern 31.8 acres of cell 3 a good 2-foot soil cover?
Inspector Cachetis, I will say that we vetted extremely tight standards with our major project contributing to the materials that came in. And that agency did extensive testing of all those soils before they came to us. The suitability of those materials, I would say from my best professional judgment, met the criteria for the 2-foot cover.
Okay. The audience doesn't agree with us. Well, let's move on then. All right, to summarize, we presented the history of cell 3, how it was forgotten as of the mid-2000s, then rediscovered as a surface site in 2013. We then saw that the full extent of cell 3 was in question and had to be verified. We also provided images of how cell 3 was being used to store construction debris and stockpiles of soil. The contract was flexible enough to accommodate the changing site conditions. We showed how reducing risk in the contract encouraged project success and a controlled cost. I talked about how we had to innovate, such as crushing and reusing the concrete and constructing temporary roadways to manage challenging scenarios. There were several contractors along with the federal and state governments actively working at either Cell 3, one of the other landfill cells, or on the closed sanitary landfill in general, and we all had to work together to achieve success. This is the video of grading on the East Plateau, the last place we had to borrow soil to complete the repairs of the 2-foot soil cover on the western 6.2 acres. Off to the right, you can see trucks bringing mulch to the site to use as nutrient enhancements for grass to grow. Mulch was stored at stockpile A until it was needed. You can see the pile of mulch in the distance. Just beyond that is the western 6.2 acres of Cell 3. So this view is from the eastern edge of Cell 3, looking west at the stockpiles and the western 6.2 acres. The truck is dropping off mulch, which will be used to enhance topsoil for grass growth. And well, the last slide should be, is there any questions? I'd like to thank you all for your attention. We hope you learned something new and found this cold case very interesting. We have time for questions.
All right, thank you so very much. We do have some questions in the queue, and I want to thank all of our inspectors for joining us and sharing their story today. So first, a quick reminder to our participants, if you have questions and comments, you'd like to share some thoughts or ideas with our speakers, now is a great time to go ahead and enter them into the Q&A window that shows up on the lower right side of your screen. If you don't have any questions or comments, you can also send that in as a message just so that we know, but I know that there's over 200 of you, and they just did a fabulous job going through a lot of details of their case, so I'll be waiting for some of those messages to come on into the queue. So as we're building up some questions here into the queue, we had a number of people who commented on some of the LIDAR imagery that you had in part of this presentation. And there were just general questions on where did you obtain this, and is this becoming more common in site investigation work?
Anne Arundel County is very good. They have LIDAR imagery available online. I'm not sure about other parts of the country, but I know Maryland has been good about obtaining that imagery and providing it to the public for use. It's free to download. Of course, you need to have the right software to display it, and we display it through GIS. I'm not sure if that answers the question, but that's where it came from, Anne Arundel County.
Okay, so it sounds as though it's very much sort of a local municipality option. It's not as though there was a national database that you were pulling this from.
I'm not aware of one.
Jerry, I could mention that I know the state of Maryland is trying to work with all of their counties to obtain LIDAR imagery. And so the imagery that may have been produced or used for this exercise should have been, I think, October of 2017.
Okay.
That was right.
Okay. All right. We had someone who had a quick question about if there was an effort to use native vegetation on the cover.
We had to use what the state required, and the state does require native grass seed, and Inspector Tyler, do you want to chime in on that? You know more about this than I do.
They give permanent and temporary seeding mixes through MDE. Also, state agencies that are known for a lot of disturbance, like the Maryland State Department of Highways, may have special blends. These are all tagged seed sources. I can't speak to all the species that they primarily use, but I can tell you that it's readily available online. You can drill in through the MDE erosion and sediment control requirements for the state of Maryland.
And okay. I'm assuming they are native grasses, right?
Native grasses. However, you'll see that they also use temporary seeding blends, what we call nursery seed, so annual rye, things like that, to jumpstart sites before they die out and the native seed sources start to take over. There's warm season, cool season, and blends that are typically used.
Okay.
Okay.
We had a somewhat related question, and one of the attendees asked, why not wait to seed until later in the fall, since the risk for lack of germination is so much higher in the summer?
We were hopeful that we could get better germination. We had to stabilize the soils as quickly as possible, and we did that primarily with using the matting. Possibly we could have gotten a water truck out there to ensure that the seed grew, but we didn't do that. So we could have done things a little differently by getting maybe a different seed mix for the summer and maybe more watering, but we thought that the seed we used would catch quicker.
Okay. One of the attendees wanted to know, will trees be allowed to grow on top of that soil final cap?
No, the maintenance will be periodic grass cutting to prevent trees from growing, and that's what occurs on cells 1 and 2 currently.
Okay.
So cell 3 would be included with that periodic mowing.
Okay, and a couple of other questions that have come in. One of the participants noted, as a consultant, the basis management of borrowed soil source is very helpful. And so they asked, is this source used in your procurement to bidders as a, quote, clean soil fill source for smaller environmental projects as well in other spaces on the coast?
That's either a Tim or a Mitch question.
Okay.
I can speak from the fort for just in general. Even though we're managing for clean soils, there is always risk. We know that. That's why I had mentioned earlier about the 250,000 cubic yards that came in during that 2017-20 period. That material was tested, one test per every 1,000 cubic yards for the typical backgrounds that would be the bad actors for handling materials and would be a cause for another action. So with all this in mind, basically we encourage jobs that do have fill requirements or borrow needs to actually do their own testing. They'll proctor to make sure that it meets select common borrow or common borrow needs as may be fitting, and they'll also if they need to verify through additional testing.
Okay. All right, excellent. We had a participant who asked, what do the filter logs filter when they're placed on top of the berms?
Well, they filter out the sediment. So it allows water to flow through, and the whole purpose is to prevent any sediment from entering the nearby streams and wetlands. So it filters the sediment out of the water, out of the rainwater.
Okay. We had a couple of more questions that are coming in on the cover. So if you don't mind, I'm going to keep reading through these ones. One of the attendees wanted to know, how did you verify that more than 2 foot thickness of your newly installed cover versus verifying that thickness of the existing cover that was left in place?
Well, when we did the initial investigation to determine the extent, the boundary of the landfill, we did all those trenches and test pits. So we had a pretty good idea. We recorded how deep we dug until we got to the top of any trash or waste. So we had a pretty good idea. The few areas, most of the landfill already had 2 foot of cover or more, and there's a few areas that did not. And as it turned out, because we had to raise up the soils in order to get a 4% slope, the majority of the area did obtain an additional foot or two of cover regardless. So without even really trying hard, we got more than 2 foot of cover in the entire area.
Hey, Jerry, just to point out too, just to make sure that you had the appropriate sub-drainage areas for your controls, they made you lift it up in the center of that area too as well.
Correct, right. So we got 6 feet of additional cover in some areas and at least 2 feet in all the rest.
Okay. All right. Another question came in about compaction requirements for your cover. They didn't know if there was a specific requirement, for example, like an equipment specification, like X passes of a D6 dozer, or some sort of measurement of the finished compaction as a percent of a proctor or modified proctor density?
Yeah, we did. We did proctor the soil. We had it tested at a lab beforehand, and then we had a geotechnical engineer in the field testing after we would do so many runs and for compaction and then test it. And then if it didn't meet the requirements, we'd do additional runs. So we're constantly testing to make sure we have the correct compaction in the field.
Okay. All right. We also had a question asking, did Maryland require investigation to verify the absence of hazardous waste sites?
Well, again, based on the trenches and test pits we did and the previous test pits in 2007, plus the well drilling, that some of the wells were drilled in the landfill, nothing was ever encountered that would be considered hazardous waste. And there's been many years of groundwater sampling in that area because cells 1 and 2 have been closed for a while. There's twice a year sampling of wells that are installed both shallow and deep. And some of those wells are around cell 3, and nothing hazardous has ever showed up in the semi-annual groundwater sampling. So we feel pretty confident that there's nothing hazardous buried at cell 3 or cells 1 and 2.
Okay.
Yeah, just and to note, the remedial investigation basically concluded with no significant risk.
Okay. All right, excellent. We're going to go ahead and switch gears here a little bit and talk about the project and contracting elements here. So one of the participants has asked if you can talk a bit more about the RIFS versus the EECA approach that you discussed on slide 41. They specifically noted, was the RIFS completed or was that effort replaced via the use of an EECA? Was the project completed as a remedial approach or as a removal action?
Okay, so after the RIFS was conducted and identified that exposed trash would be an issue, that's when we decided to do a non-time critical removal action, which to do that, you need to produce an EECA, Engineering Evaluation Cost Analysis, that's an EECA, and an action memo. And as Inspector Kintek mentioned also, we were coming up to we had a 5-year contract period. And knowing that we cannot get a proposed plan and rod through the regulators in that time period and still have time to install the cover, that along with the potential trash exposure allowed us to do the non-time critical removal action and proceed in that path.
Okay. All right, excellent. We also had another participant here who wondered if you might reflect a little bit and comment if there were some phases of the project that you would have liked to have done differently.
Oh, no, I think we did everything perfectly. I haven't really thought about that.
That's okay. We can come back to that.
Yeah, well, I have one element that I'd add. There was this adaptive nature between the Fort Meade stockpile management team and the cover requirements for the Western Cover project. And there was constant communications that allowed for some adaption to be able to make available soils at the right time. I could give you an example, and it's primarily where I had clean materials coming from construction jobs that could be delivered directly to the AECOM job site.
Okay. Yes, that was helpful. Okay. Rather than that soil being dumped on stockpile A, they were dumping it onto our western 6.2 acres, which saved us some time moving soil from stockpile A to our site. And let me go back to things I would do differently. Definitely, I would do something different about getting the grass to grow. Maybe a different summertime seed, or maybe waiting until the fall, or maybe watering more often. So that's what I would do that differently.
Okay. Okay. We had another question about how you obtained approval, or how approval was granted to close Cell 3 under the pre-1988 landfill regulations. Can you talk a little bit about that process or any challenges you may have encountered?
Well, we were able to find a document that stated that two foot of soil was placed over Cell 3 in 1976, and the regulations changed in 1988. So we had a meeting with the MDE solid waste people, and they agreed, based on the document we had, plus, you know, the fact that we went out there and do some preliminary investigation, confirmed that there was at least 2 foot of soil over parts of the landfill. So it helped having that document. It helped immensely having a document saying that it was covered in 76.
Okay. Okay. And in talking about that, is the landfill now documented permanently in records so that it doesn't turn into another cold case again?
Yes, it is. It should be with the MDE Solid Waste. It's definitely with Fort Meade. And I know about it, so I won't let anybody forget.
Gotcha.
I'm kidding.
All right, and then one other question that I see here in the queue is about briefing and outreach that you've done on this project. A number of people were just interested in who may have been informed or learned about the project, specifically a group called the Restoration Advisory Board. So just wondering what sort of outreach or briefing you did on the project.
Yeah, Fort Meade has a very active Restoration Advisory Board. That's a group of public participants. And Fort Meade meets with them every other month on the third Thursday at 7 p.m. If anybody's interested, they could join. They could join in the meetings. And, yeah, the Restoration Advisory Board was briefed on the Cell 3 work several times during the planning stages, after the RIFS, and I think after the ECA for the non-time critical removal action.
Okay, excellent. So I'll just send out one last call to our participants that if you have a question that you'd like to chime in or send out to our presenters, now is the time. Again, you can use that Q&A window to type in your questions or comments. If you have no questions, go ahead and let me know that you don't have any outstanding questions for our speakers, and that'll help us know if it's time to move on to the next segment in our agenda here today. We've had some really great questions coming in. I did have other comments where people really appreciated the presentation. They really liked your graphics and your visuals. You had some great photographs that made it much easier for them to follow along with the story. One person noted it felt like they were on the site, so I just wanted to be sure to relay those messages and comments. And so I don't see anything else coming into the queue. So we do have a few other elements and final reminders that we wanted to walk the audience through, but I wanted to ask you, Jerry, are there any closing thoughts that you'd like to leave the audience with?
I want to thank everybody for the questions, and on behalf of Inspector Klein, Inspector Peck, Inspector Kyler, and myself, we'd like to thank everyone for attending and hope it was all beneficial.
All right, excellent. Thank you so much. I'm going to echo those thanks, and I want to thank all of our presenters, all of our inspectors that is who joined us today, as well as the over 200 individuals who joined us in today's live broadcast. I have a few final reminders that I'd like to walk through before we close things out today. So I'll just remind everybody that today's webinar is part of an ongoing series or partnership between EPA and FAMI, and this is all done under the guise of their Design and Construction of Hazardous Waste Sites seminar series. So we currently have 7 events planned for this fiscal year. We completed one in January. The March one we had to unfortunately postpone till today, but we are now completing that one. We have 2 coming up next month in May, and then 2 in July, and 1 in September. So they're also working on a partnership between EPA and FAMI on construction management training. So we do encourage you to visit the Design and Construction of Hazardous Waste Sites, or the DCHWS website, to learn more about these upcoming events. And just to give you a quick commercial for those 2 webinars that we'll be hosting here on CLUIN next month. We have 2 different talks that will both be given on the same day, and they follow one right after the other, but we do realize that some parties may only want to sit in on one. So you actually can register for one or both talks. They'll take place on May 12th. The first one, which will look at site assessment, design considerations, and performance results from an innovative barrier application at a large chlorinated plume in Texas, will run from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern. And then we'll follow that with a second talk from 2 to 3, which will be looking at successful high-density sludge or HDS treatment and the plant design for an acid mine drainage site. So we do have registration open for those events. They actually will be run on a new webinar platform. We are switching over to Zoom Webinar. So if you have ever attended an event with Zoom, we will be using Zoom for those sessions next month. Feel free to send me comments in the Q&A if you're happy and looking forward to Zoom. I know that I'll be looking forward to hosting those events as well, but I do encourage you to register for one or both of those sessions. We do continue to offer free technical sessions like today's webinar, along with a whole collection of information related to the cleanup and characterization of hazardous waste sites. So I encourage you to stay connected with us by visiting us at the CLUIN website. You can subscribe to our podcast feed. So every time we record these webinars, we post them. You can actually find us in the iTunes store and a number of other podcast service platforms, so that you can get them delivered to you as soon as a recorded webinar is available to watch or listen to on demand. And then I encourage you to sign up for our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, which goes out on the first of each month, where we do our best to highlight new web resources, documents, and online events related to hazardous waste site cleanup. So the last thing that I wanted to walk through, which is the most common request that I get from our participants, it's just a quick reminder that presentation materials, including copies of the slides, are already available to download from that seminar homepage. I made it available in the Q&A window, so you should have that link. It's the same page you went to when you checked in for today's session, so you can bookmark that and reference it later on. We also have contact information for our speakers, as well as our online feedback form. So I do want to hear your thoughts on today's delivery, both in the content that was covered, along with the tools that we used to host today's session. Now, oftentimes people ask me for certificates, PDHs, CEUs. While we do not issue
formal hours such as PDHs or CEUs, we can provide you with a webinar participation certificate if you fill out the seminar feedback form. So I've already included that in the Q&A window. You'll see it on the middle right as well, the seminar feedback link. Just open up that form, fill it out. I read each and every one of those responses, so I encourage you to share your thoughts. And then when you're done, as long as your email address is entered correctly and you check the box at the bottom of that form certifying you were here for the whole delivery, you'll then immediately have access to a certificate that you can either print out or save for your own records. Oftentimes, our participants are able to take their registration emails, these participation certificates, and copies of the presentation materials, and provide that as enough documentation for their own institution to get credit for attending our sessions. If you joined as a group, each person can fill out that feedback form to get their own certificate, even if you didn't register on your own. So whoever signed up for the session, please be sure to pass on the link to that seminar feedback form to those who gathered with you. And just a quick reminder, if you don't get a certificate, it is likely that you didn't check the box at the bottom. You can feel free to reach out to me directly at ballant.gene@epa.gov. We'll try to reissue that for you as soon as we can. So with those last reminders, and again, a great big thank you to all of our wonderful inspectors who joined us today, along with the over 200 of you who joined us for our live delivery, I want to thank you for being here and hope that you found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time. And with that, we'll go ahead and